All right, welcome everyone. It's been a long day. I'm the person standing between you and the beer. So we'll try to make this quick. For those that don't know me, you guys saw me at lunchtime with Donovan doing the talk on the VHD stuff. So that's the SharePoint sideshow work that we've been doing. And we talk about more of that at the end. But I'm a technical evangelist for SharePoint. I work with Steve and Donovan and Chris and everybody else that you saw today. And I focus specifically on SharePoint, things around Silverlight and SharePoint in particular, and Windows Phone and SharePoint. You can reach me at my email address is here if you want to talk about stuff offline. But let's get started. So I have about 45 minutes, and we have a number of slides to go through. So this is... This is actually a Silverlight Pivot application running on SharePoint that enumerates all of the SharePoint sites that are out there in the wild. And so it allows you to very easily drill down into information about the various sites. And again, this is all deep zoom, so I could deep zoom into any of these sites if I want to see them. I can filter by industry. You know, we can just pivot this information around, and it shows you the sites. I can also do things like view it as a graph, if we want to see it by industry. You know, we can easily see various information. Again, this is a great example of where Silverlight really brings to life the data that's already you have in SharePoint and leveraging the SharePoint platform, the lists and libraries to show that data. And so we can drill down. We could even do searches for information, so like we can look up banks. And then it'll filter based upon whatever we have. Tunisia has one bank, I guess. So we can look at the site, right? And you get information about the site. We have deep zoom. The images aren't that high fidelity, but you get the idea. You can actually drill down to the site and see information. So a really great example of just the things that you can do with Silverlight and SharePoint to give you some feeling for how this works. But what I want to talk about today, because we only have a short period of time, so we only can talk about a little bit of stuff, is I really want to talk about how do I get my Silverlight application in SharePoint, right? And we really fundamentally, no matter what we do, we always have to answer two questions. So as you program Silverlight and SharePoint, you're always asking yourself these two questions. How do I store my ZAP file, which is the Silverlight application package file, which is just the zip file, if you will, of Silverlight stuff. How do I get that into SharePoint, and where do I store that in SharePoint? That's the first question you have to answer as a developer. And then the second question is, how do I host that Silverlight application? Is it a web part, which is what we traditionally think of? Is it something else? Is it using the built-in web part, which I'll show you? Is it using a custom web part? Right, so you're answering these kind of questions as you go along. Fundamentally, what you want to do is use the code solution at the bottom. I'll show you the node code. Steve started to show that a little bit earlier, but I'll show you what that looks like, and I'll show you the code solution, which is really the one you want to use. And the code solution is packaging your ZAP file inside of your WSP. So when you finish developing, you hand that WSP to your administrator. To them, it's just another WSP. They don't know that there's actually Silverlight applications embedded that get deployed. And so it's a very natural thing. There's nothing different you do to deploy your Silverlight applications from that aspect. So let's go ahead and get started here. So the first thing I want to show you is I have this Silverlight application here. Let me open it. The Silverlight application displays a number of contacts, and we can open the XAML file here for the main page. So here's the back side of the page that you're looking at. If we run this application, what we get is the normal built-in Silverlight test harness page that shows you the Silverlight application running, right? If you look at the top here, you see that it's just running off the file system. So it's just a local instance of the application. But it gives me this really nice, rich Silverlight application. You know, a lot of gratuitous animation that you'd expect from a Silverlight application, right? Clicking on the item will allow me to edit the fields behind that item, right? Things that you would add to a Silverlight application. But the point is that it was very easy to just start this application. But now how do I get this into SharePoint, right? That's our first question we need to try to figure out here. So what happens is that when I build this application, what we have is our zap file. And the zap file is right here. So you can see that we have just the single zap file. That is the package. Now, when SharePoint build, when Visual Studio builds, it kind of builds all the files out loose, and then it packages them all up into the zip file. So you could look at the loose files if you want to while you're doing development, but ultimately you just need that one package file. So let's go to our SharePoint site. So here's my SharePoint site, and I want to host this page. So what I'll do is I'll upload this zap file to my documents library. Again, you need to decide where you want to put that. So let's just go ahead and upload this file. Let's browse to the location where my zap file is. Choose the zap file, and then we'll say OK. Save it. So now my Silverlight application has been installed or uploaded to my SharePoint document library. So we've solved the first problem, which is where do I store it? Now we need to figure out how do I host it. And for that, what I want to do is I want to just grab the shortcut path to where this is installed or where this was uploaded. And we'll use the built-in Silverlight web part to display this. So let's go ahead and create a new page. Call it. So here I have just a blank wiki page, and I'll do insert web part. I'll browse down to the media and content categories. So down in the media and content categories, then what we'll choose is Silverlight web part. And we'll add it. Now, it only asks you for one property, which is the path to the Silverlight application. That's what I copied earlier, so I'll just paste that in. Now, I have the application. Now, it doesn't quite fit just right out of the default height and width, so we can adjust that. So let's edit the web part. And we can adjust the height and width to be... the right height and width. Let's do 640 by 480. We could do other things real quick right here. If you want to pass any custom initialization parameters to your Silverlight application, you can do that here. One note is be careful. These are URL encoded, so if you try to consume them in your Silverlight app, you need to decode them first. So that catches a lot of people. So there we go. We have our Silverlight application running now, hosted in SharePoint as a web part. Cool, right? You can applaud. Don't be shy. All right, good. So this is the basic, right? But we've just solved the two problems, right? How do I get my zap file into SharePoint? And then now what? How do I host it, right? But you don't want to do this, right? This is analogous to developing your production site using SharePoint Designer, right? You just wouldn't do it, right? And so we as developers need a way to programmatically do everything that we just did so that it goes out as a package. So let's take a look at that. So let's go here and let's leave that for now. So now what I have here is in my Silverlight project. What I want to do is I want to first add a SharePoint project. So let's go ahead and add a new project to our solution. I want to create an empty SharePoint project. And let's call it SharePoint Out of the Box Project. And we'll say OK. No, here I get the same choices that Paul Yuck talked about this morning, whether I want to do sandbox or farm solutions. The whole concept of doing Silverlight is to assist you and create these great sandbox solutions. So most of the time, you always want to choose sandbox, right? There should be very rare cases where you want to choose farm solutions. And if you do have to choose a farm solution, most likely you want to segregate your project into two, the part that's the farm part and the part that's the sandbox part. That way you only have to really security review and deal with the farm part, and it's a smaller piece of the total picture, right? So most of the time you want to choose sandbox solutions. So we'll say okay and finish. So now I have an empty SharePoint project over here. So we'll look real quick. So I have my Silverlight project and I have my SharePoint project in my solution. What I want to do first is make the SharePoint project be the startup project so that when I hit F5, it all works. Another trick that you want to do with your SharePoint projects is that if you look at the properties of the project, click on the SharePoint tab on the left, and then at the bottom, you want to click on the Enable Silverlight Debugging tab. This will give us the ability to debug our Silverlight applications, which you could do the other way, but it becomes a more manual process. This is all automatic on F5. So we'll just click that and choose Enable Debugging. Save that and close. Okay, so now what I have now is I have a Silverlight project and I have my SharePoint project. I need to hook those two together. I need to wire them up together. And so how do you add a reference to another project in Visual Studio? Project reference, right? But is that going to work? What happens when you add a reference to a project in Visual Studio? What are you referring to? The DLL, right? We don't want the DLL. We want the ZAP file. So that doesn't work, right? And so, when they were first building this, I had some very creative coding techniques around getting around this problem. And the Visual Studio team said, well, maybe we should add something to the product to stop you from doing these things. And so the thing they added was, it's a little bit complicated, and so I've created a Visual Studio add-in that makes it a little bit easier. And so now if you use the Visual Studio add-in, and I'll release this next week so you guys can use it as well, you just simply come here and say add new item, and then I can just say create a Silverlight custom web part. And this is going to do a whole bunch of things for us here. So let's just do SharePoint out of the browser web part. And then we add. Now what's going to happen was what this add-in does is it makes the reference to the ZAP file, right? Solving the first problem of how do I deploy this thing. The second problem is how do I host it? So it automatically creates a visual sandbox web part to host the Silverlight application. And then the third thing it solves, which is kind of another problem, is how do I test it? So it creates a test page for me, inserting the web part that I just created onto that test page, and then we're all set to go. So what we have here is if we look over here on the right, so on the project here, I have my visual web part. That's the web part, right? That piece is analogous to when I went to add web part, Silverlight web part, and I browsed to the ZAP file and I stuck it on that page. That is the programmatic equivalent of that. Then underneath there where it says master page gallery, that's where I went and uploaded the ZAP file to my shared documents library. Here, by default, the extension installs it in the master page gallery client bin folder. That way it's hidden from users, but still can be managed as a gallery item that administrators can browse to it like a document library and manage the ZAP files. But users won't inadvertently stumble across it like it is if it's in your shared documents. And then the last one creates the actual test harness page. Remember, I went to add new site page, and then I inserted the web part on that site page. That's the programmatic equivalent of doing that. So I'll run it first and then show you what it looks like. So we're good here. Let's just actually, I want to change one thing here to make it easier. So we'll just run this one now, see how it works. So now what happens is Visual Studio packages everything up. It will open the file. If we're fast enough, I could even come in here and come down here and set a breakpoint. So when I set a breakpoint here, so I have my page, and now at the top of the page, here's the new test harness page that was created for me. And then if I click on this, it has embedded in this the web part that we did, and it hits my breakpoint because I set that flag to say break in Civilite. So I hit the web part here. I can hit F5 to continue running. And the end result is now I have a Silverlight web part hosted on my test page that's ready to go and debug. So now I can get down to the business of actually creating my application, not wiring up all the plumbing of getting SharePoint to work, right? So the way this works here, let's drill down into this project a little bit here. The first thing I do is I create a Visual Sandbox web part. So Visual Sandbox web part. So Paul talked a little bit about this morning. So Visual Studio ships with a visual web part. Visual web parts are nothing more than an ASCX control that's hosted. But you can't use visual web parts in sandbox solutions because does anybody know why?
The ASCX file has to be copied.
Exactly, right. So the ASCX file has to be copied to the file system, and you can't do that in sandbox solutions, so that doesn't work. So they came out with the Power Tools, and the Power Tools adds the ability to create sandboxed visual web parts. And the way they do that is when you compile, behind the scenes, they're compiling the ASCX into the DLL. So they compile your ASCX into the DLL, and the DLL goes. Right? There's nothing to say you can't use a control. You just can't have one that's written to the file system. So that's what they do. The second big thing that they do in that assembly, which makes it mandatory that you have this, I think, in my opinion, is that in sandbox solutions are, there's no difference between a sandbox and a farm solution. The only difference is how they're deployed. If I have a file and I deploy it to the solution gallery, it's a sandbox solution. If I have a file and I deploy it to the farm, it's a farm solution. But Visual Studio tries to help you by filtering the IntelliSense to keep you from doing things in the sandbox that you shouldn't be able to do. But out of the box, they only do first level IntelliSense, which means that if I cut and paste code from some site, I may not realize they're using things that don't fit in the sandbox. My code will just compile. Now with the add-in, they actually do a compile time checking against the sandbox to make sure you can't accidentally put stuff in the sandbox that you weren't aware of. So anyway, so that's a long story short for that. Now, so here in this case, on the add-in, I have two web parts. I have a regular Silverlight web part, which is basically reusing the built-in Silverlight web part, and then I have a custom Silverlight web part. The custom Silverlight web part is what you see here, and this creates the visual web part that hosts the Silverlight application. So if we look down past here, here's my Silverlight application hosted inside of this visual web part. Right? Hosting Silverlight is nothing more than an object tag, right, when it comes down to it. So this is my object tag for Silverlight inside of my visual web part. Now, what I've done here is on the source value, I've actually dynamically look up the name of the website, and then I put in the path to the zap file here on my site. Does everybody see that? The other kind of tricky thing here is that there is this field here, which is MSSP URL, which is this one right here. This is a variable that's actually used by the client object model. You know, in the client object model, you've seen some examples where you see SP client context dot current. That dot current property comes from the fact that it's passed into this property. If you don't set that, the dot current won't work. The built-in Silverlight web part has this built-in, so it just works, and so people may not be aware that this is what's going on. If you're building your own web parts, or like this one, you need to pass that in yourself. So that's that. So there it passes in the current context of the website, so we get our path, and then we're good to go. So that's the visual web part. Now, the other ones are fairly straightforward. Now, this is the one that, this is how you define, so let me look at my properties here. So now, we talked about earlier, when you add a reference to a project in Visual Studio, it adds a reference to the DLL. So we needed another way that adds a project reference for Silverlight projects. And the way they came up with it is that you add a module, right? In SharePoint, the way you deploy files is a module. So here I've added a module to my project. And once you add a module to your project, there's a property down here called Project Output References. This Project Output Reference is how you reference the Silverlight zap file from another project. So this is sort of the alternative, you know, add project reference mechanism. And so if I click on the collection, what you see in the dialog is basically a reference to that project, my Silverlight project. This is the thing that tells the Visual Studio Project System to go grab a copy of that zap file and then build it into the project when you build, right? That this is how that mechanism works. So you could totally do this all yourself manually. But again, that the extension I wrote does this for you. And then the last piece is just to dynamically build a test harness page to host this. So all of this code is basically boilerplate. The only thing I changed, I just copied a basic file. All I do is right down here at this part, you just actually stick in a reference to the visual web part that we just created into my page. So then when it uploads that site page, it already has a reference to the web part that we're building right in our project right now. Does that make sense? Cool. All right. So that's all there is to that. So any questions on hosting? Easy, straightforward, good. All right, so one more thing I want to show you here before we go. So that was hosting, but what we see here in our page is that when we ran the application before, we had just a, let's go back and run this application. You see here I have two files, John and Jane Doe. Those files, if we look at the application itself, these files come from this local store. So this application has a pluggable data provider model. And in this data provider model, it basically implements the iContext store interface. This is just something in the application. And then I just hard-coded these two names in here for my local data, right? But really what I want to do is I want to connect to SharePoint data, right? And there are really three ways you can connect to SharePoint data. I can use Azimex services, old school, right? I can use client object model, which you've seen a little bit today, right? The client object model allows you to read and write data, things that are in SharePoint DLL. It's good for JavaScript, Silverlight, and the client object model, and the .NET CLR. You can use WCF data services, right? REST, Donovan showed you some of that, and you'll see that in an example. So those are really the ways that you want to access data from SharePoint. In this case, I have just this one. But now what's interesting in this application, if we open the application in Visual Studio, what happens is we get this page, right? But this isn't really the correct, this isn't really the correct representation of this application, right? Visual Studio gets it wrong in this case. And this is why if you're doing SharePoint development with Silverlight, you really have to use Expression Blend. And in fact, you can't use Expression Blend because you really need to use both. Because Visual Studio has better code handling, and Expression Blend has better design time experience. So when I open this in Expression Blend, you see that Blend gets it right. Blend knows which is the correct date, which is the correct view state to show in the application. And another thing Blend does is what do you see going on here on the page? It's populated with the data. So how did Blend get that data? Well, it's actually running your application in design time, right? Which is an important thing to think about when you're doing this. Now, what's interesting here is that we can add other providers. So let's take a look at that real quick. Let's add another provider. So here what we have is I've created a provider for the REST interface. Here I've just implemented the iContext store and then point it at my VTI bin listdata.svc file, which is my REST service endpoint. And then once you do that, it's the standard ADO.NET WCF data services entity stuff. I just go to Visual Studio, add a service reference. Visual Studio generates all the entity framework stuff behind the scenes for me. And from this point forward, I'm just doing entity framework programming. It's nothing specific about SharePoint that I'm doing. So for example, here what I have is I can just take the contacts list, which is the list I want to do here. So if I look at my SharePoint site, my contacts list here is just a list of people, right? There's like Guy and Kevin and Roberto. And so I'm just referencing my contacts list here. And then when the data comes back, all I do is I iterate through the contacts list, filling out this data structure that the application is looking for, right? And then I just pass that data structure back to the application data binds to it, right? So that's how this works for the REST interface. Implementing it for the client object model is nearly identical in terms of what we do. First thing I do is I add a service reference to the SharePoint.client .Silverlight DLL, and then the SharePoint client Silverlight runtime DLL. And those two DLLs are in the SharePoint, those ship with SharePoint. So add a reference to those. That is the client object model. So we're adding a reference to the client object model. Then the next thing all I do here is I get a reference to the current context right here. Then all I need to do is I need to load up my data. So I'm going to say here I'm doing client object model stuff. You've seen this a few times today. I'm just saying go get this list. I want to get the context list. And I have to write my camel, but since I'm lazy, I use the static method create all items query, and that generates the camel for me. So that's built into a camel query object. I call load, which actually loads the query on the query stack. Because the client object model is very efficient about how it uses network resources, so it doesn't actually call the server until I say so. So I can keep adding things on the stack, and then when I'm ready, I say, now go do all that work on the server at one time. And so here I call execute query async to actually make the call to the server. When it comes back, all I do is the same thing I did with the REST interface. I just iterate through the object model, building that object that I need to send back, that data context object. The difference here is, so take a look at this code here, and then take a look at this code here. What do you see? What was that? Yeah, so my callback event handler. They're both asynchronous here in this case. The difference is that this is strongly typed, and this one is not. And the reason is the client object model is very dynamic, so it returns things back as a dictionary collection of field values. Right? Because I don't know when the data is going to change, and it works on every list. The entity framework is different because I'm actually adding a reference to this schema, and it generates the entity framework for me, so I have a strong type of what the values are. Now, the thing is if the data does change, I need to regenerate the entity framework, where the client object model will just dynamically handle those changes, right? Because it's doing just a dictionary. And then the last thing with the client object model, since we're asynchronous, the key is that calls coming back happen on a background thread. So in order to get back on the UI thread, I need to use the dispatcher.begin invoke. Right? And that puts me back on the UI thread to do anything I want to do. And here, just a shortcut, I use a lambda expression to do this here through the anonymous type. Right? And we're back. So that's it, right? So I've added two plugins. I created one for the client object model. I created one for REST. We can dynamically choose between them, and we see how it comes back. Now, in my code, what I have is I can say, no, I don't want to use this one anymore, which is the local store. So we'll comment that out. I want to use the client object model store. And so if I uncomment this one, now, if I save this here, and let's go look at my client object model code just for a second. So my client object model code, well, I want to show you this first before I give away the secret. If I open this now in Expression Blend, let me come back here and rebuild this. Okay. Now, when I open this in expression blend, what happens? Right, my data's gone because I can't go to a SharePoint list. Now, if this isn't totally obvious to you, what's interesting is that Visual Studio will come back. There we go. Let's open this again here. Okay, no data. But what I can do here is I can say here in my failed event, I can put in a breakpoint, right? Or I can put a breakpoint here in my contact saying what's going on here, and then I can choose debug, attach to process, and I can actually attach to expression blend to actually debug my design time code that's in expression blend, right? And so what's especially when you're doing this stuff, it may not be obvious, but this is actually very helpful because many times all of a sudden something stops working in the designer and you may not know why, right? Because if you're building these things, you want to make sure you have a great design time experience for designers that are going to be using your stuff. And so here if I run this, we can see it actually goes out and tries to make the call. Hopefully it'll fail. Or maybe not. But it actually does go out and try to make the call and fails here on this one, which is what we saw, right? Do that again. So there's the first one, and there's the fail. So you can see that it's actually trying to make the call, but it fails and comes back. And what we can do here is we can actually, you know, you could actually debug this, and you could see, you know, what the error message is and understand why it's not working, right? So this is very interesting. But so there's the workaround for this is, let's go ahead and stop debugging. The workaround for this is that we can actually, let's comment this one out. We can actually say that, hey, if I'm in design mode, then use this local sample data store. And if I'm actually running, use another store. So if we save this and build, make sure that's good. Hopefully we'll get data here. Or not. Okay, we're good. Did I save everything? Let's go ahead and open this again. So now we have our data again, even though I'm still wired. Now, I have that data, so now all I need to do here is if I actually come here and run this project, what you'll see is that while I'm looking at it in the designer, I get the John Doe, but when it actually runs, we should, if everything works right and the demo gods are good, we should actually see all of the data coming from that SharePoint list with Guy and everybody right at the top of the list. And there we do, right? So now we have everybody. So now in runtime, I can see the real people. And then at design time, I can still do my design time stuff against SharePoint sample data. Right? Cool, right? All right. So we only have a few more minutes, so I just want to touch upon one more subject here really quick. Just something to think about as we go along here. So the last thing to think about is what are the other considerations that you need to think about as a Silverlight developer for SharePoint? So some of the first ones starting on the left around the platform, like what is your down-level experience? What if they don't have Silverlight installed, as rare as that may be? What if they don't have Silverlight installed? What is your fallback position? What is your plan B, right? And to think about that ahead of time to make a great experience for them, even if they don't have it. And then coupled with that is, What is the install experience? How can you get them to install Silverlight? Right? Now, the way it is in SharePoint, what happens if you don't have Silverlight installed? You get a yellow status bar saying, hey, you know, the experience could be better if you install this. Try to encourage them to install Silverlight, right? Try to show them the benefits of why they would want to do that, right? That's what you need to do. And I'm going to show you some examples of these in a second as I talk through them so you understand what the issues are. So Ribbon, how can you integrate your Silverlight applications with the Ribbon, right? You really want to make your Silverlight application feel like it's part of SharePoint, not that it's just stuck on as some island in SharePoint, right? So more than web parts, right? So we talk about web parts, but Silverlight can be more than web parts, right? Because it's just the object tag. So any place that there's HTML inside of SharePoint is fair game for Silverlight. Headers, master pages, field controls, sidebar, navigation, right? On and on. Any place where you can put HTML inside of SharePoint, Silverlight can be in that spot as well, right? So think about those as you build your applications. Skinning and theming, again, if somebody changes the theme colors of SharePoint, you want your Silverlight application to feel like it's part of the SharePoint site, right? And I actually have a CodePlex project I did last year that's a Silverlight application that actually reads the SharePoint theme files and dynamically generates Silverlight themes based upon the SharePoint theme files, right? Because the way SharePoint themes work are you upload the THMX file to SharePoint, it behind the scenes generates CSS files, and those CSS files are what SharePoint actually uses, but the THMX file is sort of the definition. We read that THMX file and generate Silverlight themes that we dynamically load Silverlight themes for Silverlight. So that works really well. Out of the browser. So there are a lot of opportunities to create out-of-browser applications. These are applications that you can pop out of the browser and show on your desktop. They give you things like full trust support, calm automation. I can read and write, you know, Outlook or Word or Office or whatever you want to do. I can access the file system. I can do printing, a webcam, video, right? Lots of things in out-of-browser. Localization and globalization support. So think about what happens when somebody flips the SharePoint site to Arabic and everything goes backwards, you know, right to left or left to right or whatever, right? How is your Silverlight application going to handle those type of localization changes within your application, right? So think about that because it's very easy now for users to flip the language that their SharePoint site is in. The last one on the last category is around JavaScript, right? You want to make your Silverlight application be a part of the family, which means that a lot of other things within SharePoint should be able to read and write or should be able to automate your Silverlight application, right? And I'll show you an example of that. For example, the one that I'm going to show you is the Silverlight media web part. I can add a video file in SharePoint, but that Silverlight video file has a JavaScript API exposed, so that other things within my SharePoint site that know how to do a JavaScript can actually play, stop the videos from JavaScript from some other web part, right? Pluggable providers, you want to make your applications extensible. So you want to use things like MEF or the Managed Extensibility Framework to provide the ability for end users to extend or plug in additional functionality into your Silverlight applications. And then the last ones are really around diagnostics. How do you get information out of your Silverlight applications? How do you make it log correctly to the ULS log? How do you understand how many people are clicking on those applications, right? Basic kind of fundamental plumbing stuff, right? But your Silverlight applications need to support that and need to fit in whatever model you're using for SharePoint. And then the last one is around SEO, right? You want to make your Silverlight applications searchable by FAST and the SharePoint search engine. So you need to do things and think about how you think about SEO in terms of SharePoint. Makes a big difference. So I just want to show you a couple real quick here of examples of these. And these are built-in examples right out of the box. So the first one I want to show you is the More Options page here. This is a Silverlight application, right? This has a pluggable provider. This is the office.com is actually a plugin that goes out and knows how to go out to office.com and find other additional templates and bring them into this application. You can write your own plugins here to extend this application to go out to your own store, wherever you're storing your templates, in your enterprise, and then people can extend their applications in that way, right? So this has a great down-level experience, which I won't show you. What I will show you is if you go to your My site, look at like your colleagues here. So here's Dan Jump. Come on, Dan. And we have the organization browser. You've probably seen this a bunch of times. This is a Silverlight application itself. This allows you to quickly browse horizontally and vertically through your organization. This is a good example of a pattern for how do you consume large amounts of data in a fast and rich way, right? Because you don't want to load your entire org into this chart, right? So you need to figure out how do I go get a chunk of data, load that, and then background load or anticipate loading extra data, right, to make that experience good. But this is an example of down level. Here at the bottom, it says HTML view, and this is the default view if you don't have Silverlight installed. So if I click on this, you get this very rich HTML view of your org chart. It looks like this, right? So it works. People can still browse the organization. They just don't have the experience that they would have. But it's a better experience than just saying, sorry, you don't have Silverlight installed, go away, right? It's not great, but it's you just need to think about it and make a down-level experience for people. Some of the other ones are around, let's go back to the home page for a second. So if I want to add a media element to the page, I can come here and do insert. I can do audio and video. And then I can browse. But do you see what happened here? If I click on this picture over here, I get various items. But when I click on this, I get this media tab. This media tab is actually being generated by the Silverlight application. So the Silverlight application is actually writing stuff into the ribbon. And it makes it feel like that application is really part of SharePoint and it belongs with SharePoint, right? Another example here is this one. Here's a little test page I created. So in this case, I have the media player on this page, but this is just JavaScript that lets me play that media control. I can go forward and go back, right? This is, again, just using the JavaScript API exposed by the Silverlight application to use it and do things in the other way. And this is important, especially if you're doing the ribbon, right? Because the ribbon is going to be making calls through JavaScript, and you need a way to bridge those calls from the ribbon to your Java, to your Silverlight applications, right? All right, so that's enough. There's more, but hopefully you get the idea, really. Think hard about where Silverlight runs in your applications and try to understand and make it really feel part or integrated with SharePoint, right? That's really important. So with that, you guys saw today at lunchtime the SharePoint Sideshow episode we did on VHDs. We're going to do one on the Easy Setup script, too. That's a script that I wrote with Chris Johnson. We put that together so that you could just run that on your Windows 7 machine. So the VHD requires server R2. The Windows 7 machine, you just fire up the Easy Setup script, come back a couple days later, and it'll have a machine fully built for you. Again, it's called Easy, not Fast. I'm sorry. And it's good. It downloads everything for you. It installs everything for you. You have the option in the config file to choose to install to a VHD. So if you do that, it actually installs to a VHD and then creates a boot to VHD file with SharePoint set up for you. So you don't have to do it on your native machine. Just choose the boot to VHD option. But it'll download everything. What's really cool is you could put, like if you own SharePoint, you can put your own SKUs in the script, and it won't download them. It'll just use the ones you already have. So if you already have fully licensed SKUs of Visual Studio and everything, you can still use a setup script to build all of your stuff. The script is extensible, so if you want to put in your own pre- and post-build steps, you can do that. You can add anything to it. We're working on a V2 right now that'll have support for server. So if you want to use a setup script to build server instances for your developers, that'll work too. So it's out there now publicly, so you can download that. But the Sideshow is a great show that Donovan and I have been working hard on. We're trying to do 200 level content just to show you where things are and get you interested in different topics around SharePoint. So if there's something you'd like to see us do, let me know. We haven't done one in a month or so because they've been renovating the Channel 9 studios. So the good thing is we're going to have green screen, so we'll be doing all our shows from Tahiti after this. So, yeah, so. The Channel 9 course, so along with the VHD, we have, it's probably about 5 or 6 days now. It keeps growing. It's probably about 6 days worth of ILT content and training, 300, 400 level content from Ted Patterson and Ann O'Connell. So all the decks, the hands-on labs, the videos are all out there for you to do, demo scripts, and it all works on top of the information work of VHD. So you can download that. You can reuse it in your own groups or companies or orgs, whatever you want to do. Is it free? Yeah. Or I could give you my PayPal account, but yeah. It's free. I have a book that came out in December. If you're interested in it, I did some work on this book for branding. I know it's a hot topic around how do I make SharePoint not look like SharePoint, right? So it's got a lot of great stuff in there about doing master pages, CSS, etc. I got a new book that I'm working on right now, which is a Silverlight 5 book for SharePoint. This book's going to have a lot of the topics I cover, like all those considerations I talked about. We're going to go in deep on how to do all of those. What's really interesting about this is Safari has these rough cuts. And so the second we write the chapter and give it to them, they post it on their site. Bad spelling, bad grammar, whatever. But you get it the second we finish writing it. And so you can preview the book as we go along and write it by going to the site. And yes, my chapters are late, so I'm working on it. So, and that's it. So thank you. Hope you had a good time, and this today was worth it for everyone. So thanks. And if you have any questions, definitely email me, visit the site, come up and talk to me if you're shy.